First letter of Timothy. First letter of Timothy, chapter 5. And we're going to read the first 16 verses. That's 1 Timothy chapter 5, starting at the beginning. Do not rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. Give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for their own family, and so repaying their parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. The widow who is really in need and left all alone puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. But the widow who lives for pleasure is dead even while she lives. Give the people these instructions so that no one may be open to blame. Anyone who does not provide for their relatives, and especially for their own household, has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. No widow may be put on the list of widows unless she is over 60, has been faithful to her husband, and is well known for her good deeds, such as bringing up children, showing hospitality, washing the feet of the Lord's people, helping those in trouble, and devoting herself to all kinds of good deeds. As for younger widows, do not put them on such a list. For when their sensual desires overcome their dedication to Christ, they want to marry. Thus they bring judgment on themselves because they have broken their first pledge. Besides, they get into the habit of being idle and going about from house to house. And not only do they become idlers, but also busybodies who talk nonsense, saying things they ought not to. So I counsel younger widows to marry, to have children, to manage their homes, and to give the enemy no opportunity for slander. Some have, in fact, already turned away to follow Satan. If any woman who is a believer has widows in her care, she should continue to help them and not let the church be burdened with them, so that the church can help those widows who are really in need.
So I'm going to look back at 1 Timothy 5 and the first 16 verses. A good servant of the Lord Jesus Christ teaches and lives out the gospel. A good church is a pillar of the truth, both holding up the truth, like supporting it, like constantly making sure that what it believes and what it teaches is the truth. So it supports it in that sense. But it also holds out the truth as it holds up the truth. It holds out the word of life to the world. A good servant teaches and lives. A good church is holding on to the truth and holding out the words of life. How does the good servant operate within the good church? How does he live out the gospel? There's all kinds of areas, but this evening we're looking at a couple that Paul kind of drills right down into how Timothy is to interact and to care for all kinds of people. It's a really interesting little section. I was preaching this morning from Ecclesiastes, a kind of repeat of one of the sermons that I'd done whenever we did the series, and it was down at Sheddington in Burgess Hill. But the point is this, that it's a very philosophical book of the Bible. Lots of kind of philosophy, lots of big thought lessons about life and the purpose of life and the meaning of life and so forth. And the wonder of God's word is that it ranges from that, the big questions of life, to, okay, so who goes on this list? Like real nitty-gritty practical. And it's quite unusual in a way. There's lots of practical stuff, of course, not all philosophical stuff, but this is kind of very detailed practical. I don't know if you thought that as you kind of read through and you thought, I wonder how this actually applies. Do we have a widow's list in Christ Church? Should we have a widow's list? Is there anybody on that list who's under 60? Whoops, we didn't read that text very well, did we? Who are the older? Who are the younger? All those kind of things. And there is a bit of cultural translation for us to do. But there are some really clear and straightforward lessons for us to connect with. And it's just a wonder of God's word that it is both lofty and exalted, thinking about God's work in eternity in saving us and connecting with us through Jesus Christ. But at the same time, who's on the list in the church who's going to get care? Right down, and this is just a kind of a specimen. This is not saying this is the only thing the church is to do in terms of caring for people, but it's a kind of specimen of a process, of a thought process that the church is to go through in thinking about how it cares for people within the church. Because you see, the gospel is both an act of salvation for us, but it's salvation not just from the wrath of God that it is, but it's salvation to live for him holy lives. What are holy lives look like? Well, all kinds of things in terms of the things we don't do, things that will offend God. But it's also a holy set-apart life in terms of the things that we do do. And some of them are intensely and immensely practical. And so we ground ourselves this evening in this text. It's 1 Timothy 5 text. Apologies, I forgot to do a PowerPoint, but it doesn't really matter now. You don't know how many points I've got and whether they're any good. But the first thing I'm going to talk about from the first two verses is church as family. Church as family from the first two verses. And I couldn't really think of a very good heading. That's probably why I didn't want to do a PowerPoint. But really, you got from 3:2-15, which is kind of church as charity, but I couldn't think of a better heading, but you'll get the idea as we start to work through those sections. But the first section, little section, but a really important one, and I'm going to spend quite a few moments on it, is the first two verses, the church as family. You see, Timothy sits in the middle of the church, not necessarily literally in the middle of the church, although that would be fine and people could gather around him, but kind of probably in the middle sort of age group. He's not a child. He's a younger man, which, as we've had defined for us a few times recently, which is starting now to hurt. Under 40-ish is the younger man. Over 40-ish is the kind of older man. So I am one of those who may be rebuked. You may rebuke me, but not harshly, as we're going to look at in just a moment. So Timothy's kind of sitting in the middle there. He's a younger man, but he's not a child. So here he is in the middle of the church, in the middle of this church family. How is he to be? Because he's a leader of that church. He's a really important messenger of the gospel. He's been appointed there and put there by Paul. And he's got a pretty tough job because the first few chapters we've been talking about how he needs to refute error, to push back on the bad teaching that many of the leaders are teaching and the bad actions that flow from that. And he can't shy away from doing that out of a kind of misguided respect, can he? He's got to say it. He's got to say what Paul's telling him to say. He's got to go for it and say it. But it's going to be really important how he says that and the attitude that he carries as he does that. So how is he to treat people? And it's a really simple answer. And you kind of know it already, but it's quite compelling. How's he to treat everybody? As family. That's what the first two verses say, doesn't it? In nice little detail. How is he to treat everybody? He's in the middle of this church. He's got some hard things to say to people. He's got to live. He's got to train himself to be godly. He's got to live a godly life. How is he to do that in relationship with other people? The church as family. Treat everybody as you would the various members of your family of kind of similar age. Love, honour, respect, openness, purity. And in good families, that's happening all the time, isn't it? We love our family members. We seek to honour and respect them. We seek to be open with them, and we're able to be open with them. Sometimes too open with them. But there's that relationship. There's that build-up of relationship where we can be like that. And there is also, there's also purity. There's also safety, isn't there, in our own families. Well, Paul says to Timothy, be like that in the church family. And he goes through various relationships, but of course he talks basically about all ends of the spectrum, male and female, old and young. He begins, don't rebuke an older man harshly, but exhort him as if he were your father. An older man, older than Timothy. And Paul assumes there will be times when you will need to rebuke. The actual word is something like to kind of beat up with your words. So the issue is not you should never say anything contradictory, controversial, challenging to an older person. That is not what Paul is saying. What he's saying is, as you do that, and Timothy would have to do that, probably some of the older men were the ones who were teaching the false teaching in this church in Ephesus. As you do that, think not grouchy old false teacher, think father I love. So you're going to chat with them, or you're going to a meeting with them, Timothy, think father I love. So how am I going to speak to my father that I love and I respect and I honour? I love them so much, I need to tell them that what they're teaching is wrong. They're teaching about myths and genealogies and all kinds of stuff that's just wasting all their time, and they're doing many other things that are not helping. But I need to confront that. But I need to do it in a way that doesn't beat them up with my words, that doesn't knock them down, that doesn't apply my fist to their face with my words. It's a really challenging thought, just in those few words, isn't it? Do not rebuke an older man harshly. Yeah, maybe you need to rebuke, maybe you need to confront, but do it so carefully. And rather than beat them up with your words, exhort. And that's a word for appeal, entreat, plead with. And of course, this has a particular application for church leaders. As we seek to sometimes confront, sometimes challenge, sometimes seek to instruct those who are older, do we do that with that kind of honor, that kind of respect, that kind of restraint, that kind of appealing to the conscience, not just trying to knock down the false argument? And it happens in families. Sometimes your children tell you what you said was stupid, what you wore didn't fit, or it didn't suit you. Or did you realize exactly what you said, or how you acted, or how that would have seemed? And we can do that in families, and generally speaking, we don't all go off in a huff and say, oh, it's terrible. But we do it in love and relationship. We need to do that in the church family. We need to have that kind of relationship, those kind of relationships in the church family. And of course, it is a particular point for leaders as they seek to sometimes confront. But it's a point for all of us, isn't it? Thinking about the older people in the church, exactly as we were thinking about this morning, in God's amazing providence, to line those two things up, to think how we are to honour and to respect. Yes, there's lots of challenges for the people who are no longer perhaps in full-time paid work and what they do, and people who are near the end of their journey, humanly speaking, and all kinds of things for them to think about, and you were thinking about them this morning together. But at the same time, they're still struggling with sin. They're still sometimes needing to be rebuked. Let's do it in a way that we think a father I love. And then there are other relationships that Paul goes on to talk about. Treat younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, and younger women as sisters with absolute purity. I think in the general connections he's making there, it's pretty straightforward, isn't it? He's just trying to say, in all these relationships, obviously there may be somebody you actually married to or you're actually sister of, but in general in the church, you're to treat them as if they were the appropriate relationship, an older woman, a mother, a young woman, a sister, a younger man, a brother, and so on. Bear in mind, Timothy's a younger man, so younger people would be his peers, if you know what I mean. So that's why it's brothers and sisters there. So I think that's the general point, but Paul adds something else in with this extra phrase, with absolute purity. And I think there's great wisdom and insight in what Paul says here about the need for church leaders in general, but all of us men, in terms of our relationships with women, particularly in the church and vice versa, to think family, but at the same time think absolute purity. So, of course, there will be and should be close relationships and times where things are shared and times when we get to know each other pretty well. And so there should be that family feel. But at the same time, a real caution and awareness that sin is always crouching at the door, and particularly in male-female relationships. So I think that's why Paul puts it there. Absolute purity, particularly with respect to the younger women, he says. And if you've been around church life long enough, and even some very recent sad news that I heard, you realise that there are church leaders counselling younger women without absolute purity, who didn't look at this, who didn't read this, who didn't take this to heart. This is not just a kind of extra bit that Paul adds on that has no significance. It's something that as church leaders, particularly as we have this position of authority and in a sense a kind of authority that other people see in us under God, to treat people of the opposite sex, particularly younger women in our case, with absolute purity. So that's for church leaders, but it's something for us all to think about in male-female relationships across the church. Now, I know you kind of, if you come into the church from outside, and particularly you hear me and Mark talk on this subject, you think, you know, we're just a bunch of legalists or something like that in terms of the various practices we have. Or you decide they're just not tactile people. It's just a kind of a character thing and so forth. And we do not want to start imposing a set of rules. There are there is freedom under God in all kinds of ways. But this is just a little reminder that while so appreciating family connection in the church, we recognize at the same time our own vulnerability. So I and Mark, and I'm sure other church leaders, and I'm sure many of you as well, would not spend time alone with someone of the opposite sex in their house or something like that. We wouldn't do that. Not because we're some kind of unhinged, lecherous men who are out to sort of prey on women all over the place. It's not because of that. It's because we recognize our own hearts and other people's hearts and all kinds of issues to do with reputation and so forth. So we want to take this to heart and say we want to treat everyone in the church as family. We want to chat with you, male, female, old and young. We want to sometimes share and have things shared with you, but always recognizing that we want to do that with absolute purity. So we put boundaries around ourselves. And it's not a set of rules for you to follow, but it's a set of principles for you to think about. Where you spend time, who you spend time with, the level of intimacy, how you greet people. Thinking about all those things. And you're either now kind of thinking, yeah, I agree with that, or you're thinking hostile thoughts. Well, go somewhere with either of those. But I'm just stuck with this thing that Paul's saying with absolute purity. How are you going to work that out, guys? And we need wisdom and grace, and not a new kind of legalism, not a whole set of rules. I'm not making up a set of rules for you. I'm just saying that we want to be an intimate family, but we want to be a pure family. And the Bible and our experience says, if you don't take steps, it won't happen. And so I have to lay that before you as a servant myself. But the bigger point, and the both wonderful but at the same time challenging point, is do you even think of church as family? All of you here tonight, I reckon, know church is supposed to be family. You've all heard enough sermons to know the church is household. But do you really think of the church as family? Do you really treat people in the church in the way that Paul is asking us to? In thinking of the older men of the church and the older women of the church as mothers and fathers and your peers as brothers and sisters? And of course, by extension, the children as, in a sense, your children, the children of the church. Do you think of church as family in that sense? Now, of course, as we've been talking about in some of our church meetings, as the church gets bigger, the expressions of that become different. They become more clustered around particular sets of people that we can be more intimate with. But that's okay. But where's the big attitude? What's your big attitude about the church? What's the big narrative you have in your head about the church? If it's a club you come to, if it's a set of meetings you come to download some new information to, if it's a set of functions that you perform, you're not really getting the New Testament idea. Every time we meet, it's a family event. And of course, family events are sometimes a bit creaky, as we know. But it's a family event. It's a bunch of people gathered together in the family of God, the household of faith. And as we meet older men, older women, younger women, we're gathering as family and looking around and thinking, these are my family. Yeah, they're oddballs, and I'm an oddball too. But I'm in this family. I'm accepted in this family. I'm loved in this family. I'm even honored in this family. It's amazing. And do you think about that? This is not something that the church leaders just think about. You know, it's all right for you. That's your kind of job. You know, you do family because that's all you got in life. You know, you haven't got a proper job, so you do that. It's not. It's for everyone to think, this is my family. And I might have a great family at home as well. Praise God for that. And you might have no family at home. But either way, this is your family. This is your household. This is where your loyalty lies. Because it's something that you've been brought into by the grace of God. And so you're seeking to treat one another as family. And as we do that, the wonderful thing is that it spills out into everything else. Because when we properly start treating each other as brothers and sisters in Christ, it helps us in our working, helps us in our worshipping, it helps us in our family life. So do you think of church as your family? That's the first point. I'm going at a rate of about 20 minutes per verse at the moment, so I've got about another 13 verses to go. So you can do the maths on that. Second section, church as charity, or substitute your own better heading when you hear the rest of what I'm going to say, because I can't quite think of a brilliant heading for it. So that's verses 3 through to 15. If you read a bit more of the New Testament, and if you've looked into the Old Testament, you will know the widows is a thing, isn't it? Widows is quite a thing. It's a thing in the Old Testament about care for the widows as a sort of specimen of the category of the oppressed and the needy. And that's true also in the New Testament. In the absence of a welfare state and in a patriarchal society, then a widow was particularly needy and vulnerable, had no independent means, had no way of supporting themselves often, unless they'd kind of been involved in a business or something. And it's a key mark of spirituality, of putting your faith into practice, that you care for widows. So you see that in James chapter 1. It's a famous verse, James chapter 1, 27, I'm sure you remember it. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress, and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. And really the rest of this section, another 13 verses, is taken up with the topic of widows. And it seems that there is some kind of a system going on in the church, because there's reference to a list, being on the list, being not on the list, being qualified to go on the list, being disqualified from being on the list. So there's clearly a list, there's clearly a system, there's clearly some people in the church who were to receive help. And what I want to do is just kind of overview it and then come back and just pick out a few key principles that are going on here. There are words about assessing need, the genuineness of need. There are some words about who should primarily do the caring, and there's some words about those younger widows and what they should have as a priority to do. And we have to bear in mind as we do that that there are cultural differences that are easy to understand, like there's no welfare state, but there are some cultural things that are not quite so easy to understand. We don't know precisely what the system was going on in Ephesus, in the church that is, and we don't know everything about all the things that were going on in the culture around them. And we also don't know quite what the pledge that's referred to a bit later is, that because some of the younger widows are going against their pledge. Did they make a pledge to stay single and so forth? We don't know. Actually, I thought this was a fairly straightforward passage. And you start to read the commentaries and say, this is one of the most controversial or difficult to understand texts in 1 Timothy. So there are things that we're not quite sure about in this section. But I think it is easy to draw some things out. And of course, the big cultural thing that we're aware of, because we thought about it when we were thinking a bit earlier in 1 Timothy, is that in the Roman world, kind of new women, modern women, they didn't want to even have children because it would spoil their shape. Abortions were common. Wet nurses were essential for a rich woman's quick recovery. And teaching, it seems, some of the false teaching actually denigrated motherhood. So on the one hand, widows are vulnerable. That's straightforward. On the other hand, in the general culture, motherhood was not considered a good thing. It wasn't considered a high calling. Very similar to our culture, actually. It was kind of considered in some ways a bit of a nuisance, having children. If you had some means, it was considered a bit of a nuisance. So that explains some of the words that we'll get into in a minute, where it's talking about kind of widows who are quite happy, as long as they're being paid for, to not get married again, because they don't think that highly of being married, and neither does the culture around them. And I think when God doesn't give us all the background, he's signaling to us that what we're supposed to do with this text is take the principles and put them into practice, rather than take the practice, which we don't quite understand, and put that into practice. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's what we're going to try and do. Think about the principles and pull those out. And the big point is that the caring that goes on in the church is to be of those who are genuinely in need. That's the really big overviewing point, isn't it? Verse 3, give proper recognition to those widows who are really in need. And that really runs all the way through, thinking about whether they're actually in need. See that how it ends verse 16? So the church can help those widows who are really in need. So there you've got the bookends, take care of those who are in need, and then ending that little section, let's work out those who are really in need, and let's care for those who are really in need. So there's something about caring for those in need, those who don't have the alternative means of support in whatever way. And Paul applies a number of tests. There's the sort of general overview that they're genuinely in need. That's kind of said. But he applies some specific tests to that as well. And we talk about family in a sense. It's difficult to know which one to do first because they're sort of overlapping in the way the text works. But there is the character test. So there's the, are they really in need? But then verse 5, the widow who is really in need and left all alone puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. But the widow who lives for pleasure is dead even while she lives. Give the people these instructions so that no one may be open to blame. So there's a character test for widows who are going to be provided for in this system. There's the character test of, are they dependent on God in prayer? Are they living out their Christian faith? The widow who is really in need and left all alone puts her hope in God and continues night and day to pray and to ask God for help. Do they have the reputation of being a faithful wife? See that verse 9, no widow may be put on the list unless she is over 60 and has been faithful to her husband. I think over 60 is really the definition of old, isn't it? Anyway, not really, just joking. But the widow who's over 60 is another bit of criteria. But more importantly, it's has she lived an upright life? The reputation of being a faithful wife. See that in verse 9. And then verse 10, being known for being devoted to good deeds, such as bringing up children. She's a widow, so she was a wife at some point, and maybe had some children. You know, what was she like in bringing those up? Was she devoted towards good deeds in the way she brought up her family, in hospitality, in washing the feet of the saints, whether that was a kind of a literal thing or whether it was just kind of taking the image of Jesus washing the feet and thinking about, is she sacrificial in her service? And then that general kind of expression of helping those in need. So Paul is applying a character test. It's very interesting. Now, because Paul is all about grace, of course, he's not saying, you know, someone's got to be really a perfect Christian, otherwise don't give them any help. You know, they can go and stew in their own juice if they're not kind of perfect. But he's not saying that. But he's saying, are they actually living out as a Christian? Are they really functioning as a Christian? If you're going to have a system, you need to think carefully and weigh carefully. Are they functioning as a Christian? Or are they, as he's going to describe for some other people, actually kind of taking you for a ride and they're not really that genuine about their faith at all? There's limited resources, so there needs to be thoughtfulness about that. So he talks about a character test, but he also talks about a family test as well. And you see that in verse 4 and in verse 8. But if a widow has children or grandchildren, these should learn first to put all their religion, sorry, to put their religion, first of all, to put their religion into practice by caring for their family and so repaying the parents and grandparents, for this is pleasing to God. And then verse 8. More extremely in the negative, anyone who does not provide for their relatives and especially for their own household has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. And Paul is saying another test. Are they living as a Christian? And are they known for having lived as a Christian? Second test, have they got family who really ought to be caring for them? There's limited resources, there's wisdom needed, so Are there family in the church who really ought to be caring for them and just being lazy, just being selfish? And Paul says, this is a really significant reputational issue for the church. To the watching pagan world around them, this will be something that is scandalous, actually, to not care for relatives. And he says, if you're neglecting this, this is denying the faith. This is actually living worse than unbelief. It's very strong words, isn't it? You think about kind of heresy in terms of denying the faith. And he says, if you're not looking after your relatives, you're denying the faith. I don't know how to put that any weaker. Sorry, any stronger. I can't make it weaker than it is. It's very strong. You say you're a Christian. You say you're a pillar and support of the church and you're holding out the word of life. And meanwhile, here's your relative at home. No one caring for them. They haven't got any food. They haven't got any heating. No one's going to pay their electric for them. No one's going to visit them ever. And you think you're a Christian doing that? You're just denying the faith in the way you do that. So there's the primacy of family responsibility. That's kind of one test. And then slightly to the side, but of course, if there isn't family, but there are other means, that's another test. So verse 16, which just gives another option, which isn't the church. If a woman who is a believer has widows in her care, she should continue to help them and not let the church be burdened with them so the church can help those who are really in need. So Paul's saying, yeah, there's a system, but if you're a widow, and there were some wealthy widows, think about Lydia and others who were able to support Jesus at times, and then some of the apostles. So there were wealthy women, wealthy business women. If you're one of those, and you're able to have some ladies staying in your house, so you support them, Paul says, it's a good thing, keep going with it. You're providing their needs, let's keep going with that so those who are really in need can be cared for. So, there's a system. Think about character. Think about, should the family be caring for them? Think about, are they already being cared for by someone else, like a wealthy person, a wealthy woman? And we think about some lessons in just a couple of minutes, but just to kind of finish the section, there's a big section from 11 through to 15, talking about the danger for younger widows. And it seems like there was a bunch of widows. And of course, again, a culture we're not so familiar with, but probably there was more mortality at all kinds of ages. So you could be a widow at all kinds of ages. When we think widow, we often think of an older person, don't we? We think, generally speaking, of someone who's sort of retirement age who becomes a widow. But of course, when people are dying at all age groups, more then because of lack of healthcare, you know what I mean? There'll be lots of younger widows too. So you've got to kind of get that in your mind and think about young women, probably women who are of what we would call in our culture now, definitely marrying age, you know, people in their 20s or whatever. And Paul seems to be referring to them as those who maybe became widows, made some kind of pledge that they were going to stay widows. But basically, if you kind of read through, you think they're freeloaders and gossips. That's kind of what he's saying. There's a bunch of women there who are freeloaders and gossips. I think that's what he's saying. And probably acting immorally. If you put it together with some other texts, probably acting immorally, but certainly going around talking nonsense, as he says, and saying things they shouldn't do, and becoming busybodies. And through that process, some of them actually given up on the faith altogether. Verse 15, some have in fact already turned away to follow Satan. And Paul's advice to them, and again, we need to not just say, well, that's a rule for us too. His advice to them is that they need to remarry. In that culture there was plenty of opportunity for them to remarry. And he says, rather than becoming a burden to the church, when there will be plenty of opportunity for you to remarry, don't make this kind of false pledge of commitment to Christ when basically you just want to be lazy. So he's advising them to see the potential that they can be wives and mothers and make a contribution to the church in that sense. See that as a high calling, so get married. So what do we make of all that? As we try and kind of connect it with our church and our church life, about whether we should have a widow's list and so forth. I think that the big lesson that will be really helpful for us to get hold of is that for the church to love well, you've got to get organized. For the church to love well, it needs to be organized to love well. And I think that's a really important lesson to get hold of. James is really good on that, isn't he? Saying, it's no good saying, keep warm and well fed to somebody and go in peace, God bless you and so forth, but not get yourself organized and provide for them. And Paul is, in this set of instructions specifically about widows, is pointing us to the general point that if the church wants to love members of the church well, it needs to get organized. It needs to think carefully. How do we care? And of course, as we have enjoyed God's blessing as we've grown, that becomes more and more important because it's more and more possible for people to fall through the slats, for people to be unnoticed. So as the church gets bigger, you need to get more organized and have more systems and teams in order that you can love well. And I think that's really helpful, really instructive just to kind of think, it's not just about an attitude. Of course, it starts with an attitude, but it needs to find its way into actual practice. And we want to love well. So we need to get organized. And Paul doesn't see any kind of conflict to say, well, it should all be just spontaneous and organic. No, he says it should be spontaneous and organized. And organic as well. But you know what I mean? He says that it needs some system and some thought. And we need to think about kind of how that applies to us. If you want to buy your wife roses, because it's a special occasion. I'm giving illustration of something I don't understand. But anyway, if you want to buy roses because it's a special occasion, you need to get organized, don't you? You need to think, have I got my wallet? Will the service station still be open? Do you buy flowers in service stations? I don't know. Do you buy flowers? Anyway, you need to think, will the shop be open that I need? I'm only joking. I buy flowers on a regular basis. Regular meaning decades, but that's sort of regular. But do you understand? You need to get organized. You need to think. I need to plan. I need to get in the car. I need to get it. And there may be spontaneous moments, but there are also moments of needing to get organized in order to show love. If I want to love my wife, I need a bit of planning. Spontaneity is good as well, but spontaneity without the means to do anything is not so good. And in the church, you know, we want to spontaneously love each other, and there are moments of just, I want to help you in this way, and that's great. But there are other moments where we say, well, we love everyone in general because we're all part of the same family, but I know that I'm really lazy, so if I don't get organized, I won't love you very well. So I need to plan, and that just works its way in loads of ways. I love you, so I'm going to try and use that prayer directory, that church directory of members, to pray for people every day because I love you. But I need to get organized because although on my best days I want to pray for all of you, I know I'm a bit disorganized, so I need a bit of help. And I love you, so I need to show hospitality. But I can't just think, I need to show hospitality. And then, you know, one Sunday in 100, I think, oh, let's invite someone around. You might need a bit of a list. You might need to get organized. And then the church itself needs to think, how do we make sure that people are being cared for? How do we look out for people who seem to be in need, whether it's practical or spiritual? Do we need teams to do that? And we have done some things in the last couple of years to do that, but we still need to be doing more. In order to love well, we need to get organized. And that's the biggest lesson, I think the most important lesson to draw out of that. Of course, Paul says some other things to us. Some about the means testing thing, which needs a couple of moments on, and then something about just how we make the best of whatever situation we're at in life. So first of all, on the kind of means testing thing. So in order to love, we need to get organized. And part of that organization is working out the priority of those who are in need. And some of you might be thinking, oh, that sounds a bit unfair. But I think Paul is teaching a really important lesson that where there is limited resources, it's the most loving thing to make sure that you've got the most money for those who are most in need. That's the loving thing to do. And that needs some really careful, wise judgments. Now, we don't want or have the system there in terms of widows, but there is something to think about there in terms of how we assess need and make priorities. And there's nothing wrong with that, as long as it is done out of that motivation of love and doing the best for those who are in need. So something about that means testing thing, some of you might want to chat with me a bit more about that later. But there's something about owning our responsibilities, whoever we are. So there are the younger widows who need to own their responsibilities, that in a culture where it was highly possible they could remarry, that they do that and seek to serve God in that way. There are the older widows who have lived exemplary lives. And so they've made the best use of their lives, and they're actually seeking now, as older widows, to live in their situation prayerfully and helpfully. And of course, there's also that important lesson about us as family members. And people always come to this text, and I'm going to stop in a couple of minutes, so I'm nearly there. But people often come to this text, particularly about kind of looking after your family, and say, well, it's different now. Well, it is. There's the welfare state that looks after people. I don't remember needing to give my mum any money. She lives in a house and she's cared for, even though she's been a widow for 14 years. So culture is different in that a widowed woman who hasn't worked is probably going to be financially cared for, probably. But that doesn't mean that we then kind of write off that text entirely. And I need to think, and you need to think, okay, so maybe I haven't got to think big in terms of money, although I might. I need to be prepared for that in the future. But I do need to think in terms of care. Now, I'm blessed by the state providing homes and benefits and so forth, but always thinking, am I doing the best for my parents, my grandparents, my uncle or auntie who've got no one else to care for them? Am I really doing the best for them? Is the state providing for them the best thing, or do I need to think about something else? And if you're anything like me, your tendency is always to kind of just think individualistically. And this text is a great challenge for us to look up and say, because verses 1 and 2, we think of the church as family, particularly we think of our family as family, and we want to care for them. And maybe God is talking to you this evening to say, not sure if you are, and maybe you need to in some different way than you are currently.